while active waiting on Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salatu wassalam, which is a sort of engagement in the, you know, in the process of preparing the way for his return. I want to take the opportunity here to actually to make a very important point, which is so actually crucial for us to when it comes to such notions, you know, like the hope and those sessions that we had before, which is at-tafakkur, or pondering upon these things. It's very important, you know. We've been talking about the other day about the educating ourselves, and we talked about the ways that we can educate ourselves. I think this is another ingredient lacking from our lives, that we don't think about these things, the very reason that we're gathered here to talk about these things is that we sort of, push and encourage our listeners and ourselves before them to think about these things, to ponder upon these things. This is unfortunately what is lacking in many of our lives. Why? Because we are so much preoccupied with our daily lives, and those worldly affairs of ours, that we don't have the time to think, or we don't feel to, think about, these things.
That's so right.
I just want to
even the radio show that we are doing now is a kind of preoccupation.
Yeah, and that's why, and that's why that the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasallatu wasallam, and before that, the Quran itself, emphasized on the importance of, thinking at tafakkur, and we have these traditions that a person who think about, his religion and the situation he's in, is more worth, worthier than a person who just worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for 70,000 years. Mm-hmm. A person ibadatu sa'atin. So just 1 hour of thinking and pondering about these very important things, worth of, worshiping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for the long time. So I think the result that we can get from these discussions, the most important one, is that first of all, we have to think about these things. And we have to put aside the time and allocate the time for thinking about these things, and inshallah we get to the best results.
Inshallah. And the hope for one final Savior to come and help us with using our intellect and mind will be fruitful. Thank you much, Sheikh Qasim and Sheikh Sadiq, for your presence in the program Viewpoints. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. This is Viewpoints. You're listening to. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN. You can download for free our previous episodes of this program. Till another episode, God be with you. Fi amanallah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you to doubt you would be the worst mistake? Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong, a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
one of the major border crossing points between Pakistan and Afghanistan. For decades, on an average, every day tens of thousands of people have been making back and forth movements on both sides of 2,700-kilometer long porous border. After the return of the Taliban in Afghanistan, many Afghans are using Pakistan as a transit route to leave for Western destinations, given 70% unemployment in the neighboring country. However, weeks before and after the Taliban's takeover, the Western media have reported such routine traveling of Afghan citizens as being fresh influx of refugees into Pakistan,
this visit of
something the visiting UN High Commissioner have not denied to be the case.
The situation is better because there is no fighting. I have often been asked, is there big refugee movements? We have not seen big refugee movements, but of course, if the state collapses, we could see a lot of people trying to seek refuge in other countries. If the state ceases to function, this will provoke a crisis that is much bigger than humanitarian.
The UNHCR has reported nearly 500,000 internally displaced Afghan citizens inside Afghanistan. Their houses were bombarded by the US and the former Afghan Air Force during clashes with the Taliban in the major urban centers like Kandahar, Herat, and Kunduz. Rest of Afghanistan largely fell to the Taliban after the US-trained Afghan army surrendered without any fighting.
We must make sure that displaced people can either go back to their homes, and some people are going back to their homes, or if they are displaced, they are under a shelter. And you know, many are not. Many are out in the open, sleeping rough.
Analysts point out that the real problem in Afghanistan is deteriorating economy, as Afghan financial system has been dependent at least 60% on foreign aid. With the change of guard in Kabul, the Western countries and the UN have resumed funding, which is far less than what the new government requires to stabilize the fragile economy. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
One of the world's largest democracies, and on the wall of the parliament, which represent democracy, there is a sentence which reads Vasudeva Kutumbakam. It means the world is one family, and this is considered the most important moral value of the Indian society. But this is apparently not the case anymore, considering the growing discord in the society. In recent months, attacks against Muslim hawkers have come under the spotlight in social media. Critics say hate crimes against Muslims increased after the emergence of the Hindu nationalist government of the ruling BJP.
In India, from over close to a decade, the Muslim poor community is being further marginalized. This is being done by boycotting the Muslim hawkers and small Muslim traders.
Experts say in India, the political notion has changed from a strong secular nation to a theocratic Hindu nation, which has given rise to violence against Muslims. Now, Hindu extremists have been busy running this show through social media. Experts say the country, which is apparently known as the world's largest democracy, is under grave danger of losing this title. In a nation of diverse ethnic and religious groups, now even beggars are being humiliated and intimidated just because of their faith and are asked to leave the country since they are Muslims. Based on reports by several rights groups, since the ruling BJP came to power in 2014, it has adopted various laws and taken actions that legitimize discrimination against the religious minorities and stigmatize critics of the government. Experts believe it could lead to instability in the world's most populous nation.
Everything is being done to further marginalize Muslims, including hate speeches, hate crimes, mob lynching, the citizenship law, criminalizing divorce, etc. Now they are picking on traders and vendors to weaken the Muslim community economically.
The ruling party of the Prime Minister Modi has fervently denied any discrimination against the community, saying India is a democracy and believes in equal rights for all. But critics say Prime Minister Modi's slogan of everyone together, development for all, and everyone's trust is nothing but a political tool to appease the voters as usual. Munawar Zaman, Press TV, New Delhi.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip took part in Friday prayer in front of the headquarters of the Red Cross. The event, organized by different Palestinian factions, aims to support Palestinian prisoners who are subjected to Israeli abuse.
We are here to stress that we will not disappoint our Palestinian prisoners and we will keep supporting them. Our prisoners are passing through difficult times inside the jails as the regime is attacking the prisoners, especially Islamic Jihad members.
Meanwhile, Palestinians consider the recent heroic escape operation of six prisoners from an Israeli jail as a slap in the face of Israel.
We are doing our best to release Palestinian prisoners, and this is an oath that we should stick with until all Palestinian inmates are free. We are working round the clock to hold meetings and put plans so we can liberate our prisoners and have them run us and with their families. Our resistance made a firm decision that the six Palestinian inmates that escaped Jilbo prison are on top of any coming exchange deal.
The Palestinian resistance mentors the behavior of the Israeli regime towards the prisoners inside the jails and those who remain free, demanding the international institutions to put pressure on Israel regarding the prisoners' issue.
The issue of our inmates inside Israeli jails is ongoing, and there are still two of the six heroic escapees out of the Israeli prison. We are here to express our total support for those inmates and all Palestinian prisoners who are fighting to achieve their demands.
Palestinians here stress they will remain committed to their duty of supporting prisoners and demanding their release. The issue of Palestinian inmates is a priority for Palestinians who will keep demanding their release until they regain complete freedom. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Demonstrations have hit Aden and other cities in southern Yemen. The protests came in response to the deterioration of public services and widespread poverty within areas controlled by the Saudi-led coalition's forces. But the demonstrations were met with a crackdown and resulted in deaths and injuries of protesters.
It is clear that the Saudi-backed regime has failed in handling of the economy, and this is what prompted people to go out and demonstrate in the southern governorates. The price of the dollar in Aden is two times more than what it is in Sana'a, and this confirms that former fugitive president Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi is implementing the agenda of the Saudi-led coalition, which seeks to control Yemeni lands and destroy the country.
The governor of Aden, Tariq Salam, said what is happening in southern cities is the revolution of the poor that will only end with the departure of all the forces of the Saudi-led coalition, including the Emirati-backed Southern Transitional Council, which controls the city of Aden.
Yemenis took to the streets of Aden to create a major popular uprising aimed at confronting the Emirati occupation authorities. And this is a result of the suffering experienced by the people of Aden due to the absence of public services, such as electricity, inflation, and high prices. This is the revolution of the hungry, and it will end when all the Saudi coalition's forces leave Yemeni lands.
6 years ago, the Saudi-led coalition occupied several cities in southern Yemen, including Aden. Since then, these areas have been paralyzed by a power struggle between the Saudi-backed Hadi government and the UAE-backed Southern Transitional Council.
The catastrophic situation in southern regions of Yemen has pushed people there to stage out and demand expelling the foreign powers. Observers say people have come to realize that the Saudi-led coalition's presence has only increased the misery in their country, where more than 20 million people rely on aid. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Since the beginning of the struggle for independence in Indian-controlled Kashmir in 1989, journalists in the troubled region have worked in dangerous conditions. The fraternity has often faced tremendous pressure from all sides, while many journalists lost their lives in the line of duty. New Delhi stripped Kashmir of its special status in 2019. Since then, the fraternity has accused the Indian administration in Kashmir of using intimidation, surveillance, interference and policing.
I think this is an attempt to treat journalists as enemy. The adversarial relationship that is there between the organs of the state and media as a fraternity is very adversarial at the moment, since last 2-3 years. And this is a result of, you know, when you treat journalists whose only job is to tell story and who are storytellers and who are not responsible for the story. They are treating, you know, as we call the shooting the messenger.
According to the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, the freedom of speech and expression in Kashmir is under threat. Michelle Bachelet has also criticized India for pressuring journalists and frequent communications blackout in Jammu and Kashmir. However, India has often rejected any criticism relating to Jammu and Kashmir. Editor-in-Chief of Kashmirwala, an independent media outlet of Kashmir, says his organization has several police cases registered against them.
In the last 2 years, we have been multiple times called, summoned, questioned, interrogated or detained. And other than that, there are a lot of other things that happen behind the curtains. You get phone calls, you get people who meet you and they tell you that this thing should not be done, that should not be done. So that creates this sense of fear in you. You always have to look over your shoulder as a journalist at what is going to happen.
The new breed of journalists in Kashmir say journalism has been criminalized by authorities in Kashmir, and many of them, like Asif Amin, are being compelled by their parents to opt for other career options. Journalists in Kashmir say New Delhi is trying to control media outlets and newspapers. They say their career is in danger. But many analysts believe in an era that almost every individual owns a smartphone and has access to social media, controlling a narrative is impossible. Shahana Bhatt, Internet Minister at Kashmir.
Farah, a Palestinian girl in her fifth grade of primary school, is one of hundreds of wounded children targeted by the Israeli regime. Shortly after the Israeli bombing of her house, Farah was transferred along with her mother and siblings to the hospital where their father.
Farah and her brothers and sisters were sleeping at home when the Israeli regime hit our house with no prior notice. They brought my kids to the very hospital where I work in. I was really shocked to see them. I've never expected to see my family in such a horrible condition. Farah was severely injured.
Farah, whose injury was highly critical, stayed for 7 days in a Shifa hospital, but her injury was severe and required traveling to Jordan for treatment. Unfortunately, all attempts failed to save Farah's legs, and she was eventually amputated.
Despite the fact that Farah has artificial legs, her morale is high. I thought that I would never see my child walking again, but now she's walking with her artificial legs.
Despite losing her legs, Farah is coming back from her treatment trip to take up her education in the school, where her teacher and classmates held a welcoming event for her.
I'm happy to be here and to see my friends once again. I'll do my best to continue my study. I know that I have to be strong and I will not give up my rights, whatever happens.
We held this ceremony to welcome Farah back from Jordan, where she spent a long treatment journey. Farah represents our Palestinian patience and resilience. She recovered from her injury and now is resuming her study. I have another 1,000 students here in this school, 20 of whom were injured during the latest Israeli escalation. Most of them have suffered from psychological stress.
Farah is now classified among a group of Palestinian children whose legs were amputated by the Israeli regime during the escalations over the Gaza Strip in serious violations of the right to life and childhood. Children in Gaza are one of the victims of the Israeli crimes. The regime has deprived them the right to live in safety. Nearly 70 children in Gaza were killed and hundreds were injured during the 2021 conflict. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
By the European Commission's own admission, the EU failed miserably to react when COVID-19 took hold in the 27-country bloc. In March last year, it was left to Russia, yes, Russia, to fly in medical supplies to the worst-hit nation at the time, Italy. This as neighbouring EU countries closed their borders while Rome cried out for help.
We responded with ad hoc solutions.
But had we had HERA at that time, our preparedness and our crisis response would have been significantly different.
HERA is the Health Emergency Response Authority, a new €6 billion agency just unveiled by the European Commission. At the launch, EU Commissioner Margarita Schinas was attempting to big things up.
Europe is the most vaccinated country in the world.
Aside from calling the EU a country, people might be forgiven for thinking the EU had illegally annexed the 17 European countries that are not in the EU. HERA is going to cost €1 billion per year for 6 years, yet another big bill for taxpayers. Some EU lawmakers are wondering if it will work. After all, EU agencies never got to grips with the 2008 financial crisis or the 2015 refugee crisis. Activists claim the €6 billion would be better spent taking in desperate Afghan refugees. They say EU countries helped to create this latest refugee crisis, but are now closing their borders.
As long as we have people having to fly their home, go and be in either refugee camps or shelter where when it's available, we're not doing enough.
Regarding HERA, the point has also been made that the EU is inviting new health crises to the bloc by not sharing its huge stockpile of vaccines to poorer countries, mitigating the risk of new COVID-19 variants. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
North Korea fired two ballistic missiles from a railway Wednesday. Hours later, South Korea conducted its own submarine-launched ballistic missile test, raising tension in the East Asian region. The U.S. singled out only North Korea's provocative behavior.
These launches are in violation of multiple U.N. Security Council resolutions. And these activities highlight the destabilizing impact of the DPRK's illicit weapons program.
North Korea remains under United Nations Security Council sanctions over its nuclear and missile programs, which prevent the country from conducting international trade and inhibits North Koreans' access to food, medicine, and other goods available in most countries. Analysts argue North Korea is being treated unfairly.
South Korea has various missiles at a significant level of development. For North Korea, the more that South Korea, needless to say, the U.S. shows such a two-faced and double-standard position, the more North Korea will develop missiles and nuclear weapons, which is not favorable for anyone. One should try to understand the situation from North Korea's position.
The U.S. has 28,500 troops stationed in South Korea, with Seoul purchasing the latest American missiles, jet fighters, and other weapons in a regional arms race. The missile tests by North and South Korea over the past couple of weeks are unprecedented in recent times. And security experts warn that because of the close proximity of the probable targets and the potential destructive power of the bombs likely to be deployed, the time to respond to a perceived threat decreases, and the risk of miscalculation that could lead to a broader conflict grows. Still, there is hope the U.S. and North Korea may be encouraged to engage in dialogue. China this week lobbied for negotiations with its foreign minister Wang Yi visiting Japan and South Korea for talks. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Lebanon has received the first shipment of Iranian fuel since the beginning of a fuel crisis in the Mediterranean country. As tens of Syrian fuel tankers drove through Alain town in northern Bekaa, a solace of better days to come seemed to be stronger than the scent of diesel itself.
We declare that we have broken the U.S. siege, and now the resistance has begun the actual face-off against the U.S. directly with this initiative taken by the Secretary General of Hezbollah.
No matter what you do, we will be victorious. You can put sanctions on us and try to keep us in the cold, but we will defeat you. You cannot beat us or defeat our Sayyid.
Men, women, and children chanted as they welcomed the tankers. They say if it weren't for Iran and Syria, what would have happened to them?
I cannot express my happiness now. I want to thank Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, and the Islamic Republic of Iran. They give us victory.
These little girls insisted on expressing their feelings towards Hezbollah for initiating the import of fuel in their own way.
We love Sayyid Hassan because he is the father of all Lebanese,
and he give us pride and dignity.
Experts believe the arrival of Iranian fuel through Syria means more than mere fuel supply for months to come.
This is a courageous and historic step that very strongly broke the sanctions imposed by the U.S. and its allies in Lebanon. This step came to say no to the attempts to starve the Lebanese people, very similar to World War sanctions. We all know that the resistance that paid its blood to liberate land won't stop at anything to provide for its people. True, this is diesel, but it smells of dignity and pride. It smells of the blood of martyrs that quenched the thirst of this land.
The tankers have unloaded their contents in several reservoirs in the Bekaa, where they will in turn be distributed to institutions and individuals in all Lebanese areas depending on demand. The first four Iranian fuel tankers docked in Syria's Banias port earlier this week. Lebanon has been mired since late 2019 in a deep financial crisis that has caused the Lebanese pound to lose around 90% of its value to the dollar. The U.S. has exacerbated the crisis by imposing a siege on Lebanon.
Some 65 heavily loaded fuel tankers have reached Lebanon, dispelling any doubt over Hezbollah's ability to import fuel due to U.S. sanctions. Hezbollah's initiative is seen not only as part of a long-term solution to the fuel crisis, but also as a strategic blow to any U.S. attempt to marginalize the resistance movement. Maryam Saleh, Al Ain, Al Bekaa.
Is the UK turning into a totalitarian state? Well, according to former British Home Secretary David Blunkett, they are certainly heading in that direction, with the proposed police crime and sentencing courts bill, which is being debated this week. He is not alone. 600,000 Brits put their name to a petition calling for the bill to be dropped, including 700 academics. 245 organisations have also called the bill an attack on fundamental rights, along with three UN special rapporteurs and the UK's Parliamentary Joint Committee on Human Rights, who called the bill, quote, oppressive and wrong. While there are many aspects of the legislation that has worried rights groups and advocates since the bill was proposed, there is one particular aspect that has recently began raising eyebrows.
The bill proposes to increase the sentence length for assault on emergency workers from 12 months to 2 years. On the surface, this may seem appropriate, but what some activists are concerned about is the way that this will disproportionately target people from ethnic minority backgrounds who are already significantly more likely to have force used against them than their white counterparts.
Dean alleges he was attacked by British police officers back in 2013 in the city of Manchester, but somehow found himself charged with resisting arrest.
But again, I'm 6'2", quite a big lad. Straight away, the police officer see my body as a weapon, and I got the whole, "He's resisting." Next thing you know, I've got six police officers on my back, like punching me, kicking me, doing whatever. They can do things to people like me and people like you with the full knowledge that the law fully protects them. And even when, like I say, when I was basically attacked by the police, all of the officers who were there kind of corroborated the same story, which was false.
Marco, not his real name, has a similar story. He was at an anti-racist demonstration when police were seen attacking protesters, yet Marco found himself charged with assaulting emergency services. Marco asked us to distort his voice.
The police was using.
This was clear in court by the footages that the police were using disproportionate force, and there was no real reason for doing that. And they even confirmed that in their witness testimony in court. And it was incredible to see that they could just claim in court that they were just punching people in the face to stop them from going to Trafalgar Square. And this was used against me, ultimately, just because I was defending myself and those around me.
Ahmed Kabbalah, London.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
It seems that the U.S. electoral system is falling apart after more than 200 years. U.S. democracy has indeed reached a dead end. It is unable to clean its ocean stables. This is undoubtedly a tragedy for the U.S. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Lee Haydong, writer. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Defective Electoral System is Losing Its Appeal. Stay tuned for more. Since the unrest at the U.S. Capitol, social chaos in the U.S. has gradually calmed down. But the U.S. public has increasingly doubted the Biden administration's ability to govern their country due to its poor performance handling both domestic and foreign affairs. This has reignited suspicion among Republican political elites and Donald Trump's supporters that the election was stolen. According to the latest poll done by CNN, among Republicans, 78% say that Biden did not win, while 54% believe that there is solid evidence of that, even though no such evidence has been made public. Questions about the outcome of last year's presidential election have been amplified again, reflecting the unbridgeable gap between U.S. political elites and everyday voters. Biden's attempts to narrow the U.S. deep political divisions will fail. The upcoming rally will unleash a new wave of political defamation in the U.S. Trump supporters are not going to the streets to heal U.S. divisions or put their country back on the right track. On the contrary, it is a campaign boost for Trump or the populist wing of the Republican Party, so that Republicans can regain some of their advantages in the next year's midterm elections. The CNN poll also said that 56% of Americans think democracy in the U.S. is under attack. Ever since the 2016 U.S. presidential election, people's impression of the U.S. election system can be summarized using one word: ridiculous. Elections are no longer about addressing macro solutions to the country's challenges. Instead, they are about name-calling, cursing, and denigrating candidates and their supporters. The U.S. presidential election in 2016 between Trump and Hillary Clinton was a campaign of personal aggression that reflected the hideous side of American democratic practice. The practical election in 2020 once again proved that U.S. politics are not about solving problems. Trump was voted out from the U.S. presidency, as many expected. However, after Trump left office, there has been no way for the U.S. system to hold former U.S. officials accountable for their failure to control the COVID-19 epidemic. Instead, those politicians who created this very tragedy at home continue to do nothing to help with the epidemic control. In fact, they keep using COVID-19 to gain political capital for themselves. This reveals the quality of U.S. electoral politics is so low that many of those elected are clowns who care for nothing but their own interest. It seems that the U.S. electoral system is falling apart after more than 200 years. U.S. democracy has indeed reached a dead end. It is unable to clean its ocean stables. This is undoubtedly a tragedy for the United States. According to the CNN poll, 51% of Americans believe it is likely that elected officials in the U.S. will successfully overturn the results of a future election because their party did not win. As for the series of changes to voting rules and regulations at the state level, 25% of Americans say both parties are acting in their own best interest. And just 12% say that both sides are acting to make elections fairer. The American electoral system revolves around party politics, so it is difficult to avoid interference from partisan struggles. U.S. politicians participate in elections to guarantee their future political career and the governance of their party. This is completely contrary to the focus of the U.S. political system when it was first established to defend national security and seek development and interests for the people. This shows the U.S. should really start to rethink about how to adjust and reform its political system. But indeed, it is very hard for the U.S. to do so now. In the internet era, the U.S. ridiculous electoral politics and deep opposition among U.S. voters are broadcast to the wider world. If even American people do not accept the outcome of their election in the future, then no one would believe the U.S. when it brags about its own merits. In the past, people might believe that the U.S. politics could gradually overcome its own shortcomings. But it turns out these shortcomings have instead become stubborn problems that cannot be overcome. The U.S. system is losing its appeal and more.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss problems and issues parents face when trying to raise their children in an Islamic way. All of our answers are as usual based upon the Holy Quran and the narrations of the Prophet and of the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all. We have in our studio guest speaker Sayyid Abdullah al-Musawi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us here again. Last time we spoke about how we should fix the wrongdoings of our children in a correct and Islamic manner. Today we will speak about how we can understand the behavior of these children so we can fix them. Dear Sayyid, please enlighten us.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajil farajhum. When we look at the behavior of a child, there are two extremes, either going in excess when it comes to this part in the scale of annoyance to little to nothing, like he's very weak. So for example, the child might be, when we talk about excess, he might be very arrogant, he have hatred towards others, for example, aggressive, very aggressive, he's addicted to TV and devices and so on.
Right.
Like, that's extreme. Or sometimes, no, he has, like, lack of doing things, like lack of doing
he's
homework.
Inactive. He sits at home all day.
Inactive. Lack of dealing with other people. Lack of, you know, communicating.
Asocial, basically.
Yeah. So you have these two extremes when it comes to, they're both annoying, but one is with doing something very little, one is doing something too much.
Right.
Now, if the child's in between, obviously, that's how we want, so we have no issue.
Right.
When we try to fix these two things and we try to pinpoint what the problem is, there are a few things that we need to keep in mind, right? Especially if we want to fix this problem. So sometimes when a child is going into excess when it comes to things, it could be this is how he expresses himself due to things that he lacks that he wants. For example, if the child wants more attention, right, or he wants more things given to him, but they're not, so naturally he will act very stubborn, or he become very lazy. Like, I'm not getting anything. Why should I care?
So I see no results, I'm not going to do anything. Yeah, so or even if I try, I'm not getting it.
Yeah, so that kind of the child wanting something is not being given to him, it could either take him too high, extreme, becoming an arrogant and stubborn and all these things, because he's like, what's the point? I'm not getting anything, I might as well, show them hell.
Right.
And I was like, nah, I don't give a damn anymore. You can
indifferent to everything.
Yeah, so that could be one. It could be a bad experience that he got from something that you've done to him.
So trauma.
So he got traumatized, or he got threatened, or he feels insecure, unsafe. So therefore he says, like, you know what? I need to give myself a sense of security, so I'm just going to yell out and scream and get my anger out.
Right.
And you see these some children are constantly angry, constantly yelling. Obviously, because he feels insecure.
We've also seen this in adults when they get frightened. Or they're in the house alone, for example. It's a dark house. They start speaking, so there's something, even shouting or listening to something.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So it's, like, it's all in your head. If you've gone through a bad experience, that will give you this result, either going too much or nowhere.
And on that note, we will take a quick break.
When I was born, the first words that I had heard were the words of Allah being whispered through my ear. And as I felt Allah's presence in my soul, that day Islam took me in its fold.
Dear listeners, welcome back to IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we're speaking about the behaviors of children. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
Since we're looking at things that, you know, could affect the behavior of a child, so sometimes the lack of skills that the child has to deal with problems, especially social problems, it makes him live this constant battle within himself, when it comes to dealing with other people. And so he lacks the skill of how to deal with people. So he find it the easy way to do is to get his things or get his way through aggression, through being an aggressive child.
Right,
because that's all he knows. He hasn't been taught anything else. He hasn't been taught, for example, how to be diplomatic with another child. You know what? He's all younger than you. It's okay. Give it to him, and he'll play with it, and he'll throw it away. Then you can take it. He hasn't been told that method, for example.
He hasn't
been told. Yeah. So he hasn't been told any skills of how to deal with other children, for example. So he's constantly yelling. He's constantly angry. He's constantly, you know, thinking the worst of people. Due to a lack of skill. Or sometimes he just doesn't have enough trust in himself. He doesn't have enough confidence in himself that he can derive the results himself. So when he's constantly being put in a place where he's constantly being tested, he will say, you know what? Why is it me always? Why me? Why are they putting me through this? Why am I being questioned? Why am I being asked? Why am I being this? And then these kind of questioning to the child and putting the child in interrogation, it kind of weakens his self-confidence. And with self-confidence, you'll come on, you'll get one of the... one of the extremes, either going high or you're going low. So these things parents need to keep in mind, that sometimes if a child is going, like you said before, if the child is being aggressive, is being arrogant, is being stubborn, because there's something definitely lacking. There's something definitely wrong that the parents need to sit with the child and figure out what's causing it. Or at least they need to observe the child throughout his day and see what is he lacking too much, or what is he getting too much that could be throwing him out of balance.
Can then Sayyid one state that any addiction present in the child is because of a lack of something in his life?
It's always a lack of something. Like we said, give the example that if someone, for example, watched too much TV, addicted to too much TV, you might find at some stage she was deprived of it. Now he's trying to make up for it.
So kind of this younger generation, they love video games and their phones. They're constantly playing. And I know children who also play a lot of outside, and they're so active, but they also at home, they play a lot. Is that also an indicator of a lack of something?
If the child is spending too much time on a video game, I know a child, he told me he spends about 8 hours on a video game. And
Every day.
And 8 hours in school. I asked myself that question. When does his parents get a time to sit with him and talk with him? Or show him love and affection?
Right.
They won't have time. So 16 hours of the day gone. Right. And the rest, and then for the next 8, he's going to be sleeping anyway.
True, yeah.
So his parents might walk past the hall or in the room, and he sees his child playing, he might say hi to him. He might, I don't know,
just check in quickly. Yeah, how's it going?
Throw a few words and move on. Or he might just tell him off and move on anyway. Yeah. Are you still playing this, that? And he just walks off. So when does the child get to see his parents?
Right.
He won't. So his addiction is the fact that he's not getting any attention from the parents to begin with. Led him to this. If the father was taking them to the park, playing with them, having fun with them, they wouldn't be that addicted.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
To say we will take a quick break.
Ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, Allah will be merciful to his servant for his intense love for his child.
Ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya.
Dear listeners, welcome back. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing the different types of behavior of children and how we can fix them also. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
Another thing is that when we need to understand the problem of our kids, is sometimes we don't have tolerance for what happens. For example, kids are kids. As I say, pygons are pygons. Kids, for example, they yell a lot, they fight with each other a lot, they nag a lot. That's called being a child. Sometimes this kind of behavior of a child, it just irritates me.
Yeah, of course.
And I start to yell and scream and shout. Well, that child didn't do anything wrong. He didn't do any mistake. Why are you yelling and fighting over? Why are you making a child a problem when it's actually your problem? You're the one who can handle these things.
Why or are you changing a child who from doing child stuff activity to something else?
Exactly. And sometimes, for example, we have children that ask too much. They constantly ask, what is this? Why is that? Why?
They're curious.
And parents can't, a lot of parents can't handle that kind of thing. And then they start telling their kids off, and then you have a problem in your hand.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Or sometimes parents, like, they try to solve this the problem. They're trying to solve it with either yelling, screaming, or threatening, or sometimes even making fun of them, right? Or they compare them to other people. They call them names. They bring them down. I don't know. So they do anything negative just to
get them off their backs.
Which actually will throw the child in one of the extremes.
Two different extremes. Mm.
So when we put the child in this state and then he can't express himself, he can't talk, he can't communicate with parents, he can't say what he wants, then obviously nothing's going to get fixed. The problem will get worse and worse as the child grows older, and once he gets older, it would become almost impossible to fix because now
it's
too late. Yeah, it's too late. He's a grown up. He has his
His way of life. Basically.
His way of life. He feels that he wasn't loved. He wasn't. He didn't feel that he was needed, and so on and so forth. So he kind of gives up. Were the opposite though? If the parents had good way of dealing with the children, their conduct was nice, and they treated that which is bad with that which is good. You know how the Quran says, "Hal jaza'u al-ihsan illa al-ihsan," or "Itba' bi-siyati bi-lati hi ahsan." Avoid that which is bad with that which is good, and then you see that it would give positive effects. It would give fruitful fruits or fruitful trees, and then the more they do good, obviously, the more you would give them, more positive feedback, which increases their balance, and they become good and doing the right thing. So it all has to do with us as parents and how we look at our children and look at their problems and try to figure out what's actually happening.
Right.
Yeah, so it doesn't matter. This is what I'm trying to get at. It doesn't matter what your child does. It doesn't matter what problem he goes at. You'll find a solution with you. Don't try to read al-ma'awadat on him.
And on that beautiful note, we thank the dear Sayyid for his time, and we also thank our dear listeners for tuning in. If you have any questions, feedback, or suggestions, you can contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also contact us at our social media under the call sign, Call of Islam Radio, on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Fi amanillah, until another program.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.